Wilson, Ms. Melvin,
Good morning, Your Honors. Emily Melvin on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Orville Carter. This case involves allegations of abuse of a 9-year-old girl who suffered from severe autism. MC's autism was an important issue at Mr. Carter's trial, yet his defense attorney, Mr. Rawls, failed to appreciate and appropriately handle the unique issues of this in this case resulting in from her autism.
So, Ms. Melvin, let me just cut right to the chase here. The problem that I have with actually all of your arguments is the failure to come to grips with the AEDPA standard of review, because we aren't sitting here on direct appeal evaluating this man's performance as a lawyer or evaluating anything else. As Harrington against Richter more recently reminded us, we're several layers of deference through, obviously, even if it were a direct appeal. Factual findings are reviewed with deference, but the state courts, to the extent that these things are not procedurally defaulted, have already looked at this and have already come to the conclusion that there are no federal constitutional violations. So how do you get around that?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't find much guidance in your brief, actually, as to how you get around it. So I'm giving you a chance here to tell me that.
Your Honor, it's our position that the state courts committed a fundamental It's our position that the state courts misapplied federal law and misapplied the facts to that law.
But let's just go one step at a time. We have the prosecutor's comments in the closing argument, and they're a little ambiguous. And the state courts read these comments, focusing on that's no due fault of his own, and from her perspective, isn't it strange that he doesn't, you know, even wink at her or anything that, you know, indicates somehow that he's her father. I don't know if I would read it that way. I don't know if you would read it that way, but the state courts did read it that way. And they come to the conclusion that, at best, this is an indirect allusion to his decision not to testify. It's nothing on the stand, of course. And they decide that there's no reversible error there. And what's wrong with that? I mean, why is that an unreasonable evaluation of the facts in the sense that Williams against Taylor talks about that?
It's an unreasonable application of the facts because what the prosecutor did here was directly comment on Mr. Carter's...
No, I don't think that's accurate, actually. I think what he's not criticizing Carter for not taking a stand. What he's saying is that because Carter didn't say anything, which he was entitled not to, the little girl is confused, right? That's all he's saying. She's confused. She has serious mental problems, so she would expect, if he's her father, to say something in the court. And that has nothing to do with the Fifth Amendment.
Your Honor, what the prosecutor here did was place Mr. Carter in an impossible position. Because he didn't speak to respond to her, the prosecutor used that to dismiss the failed identification, and she directly commented on his silence. She said he refused to acknowledge her request for her identification.
But you can comment on what you can't comment on is the refusal to testify in your own defense. That's what you can't comment on. You can comment on silence as such if it's not a comment, direct or indirect, about failing to take the stand.
And if we do think of it as a testimonial comment, it's at most a refusal to acknowledge that he's her father, which I don't think was in any doubt in this proceeding. Everybody knows he's her father, and the prosecutor is saying he refused to acknowledge. Now, you might acknowledge by waving your hand at her or something without a single word coming out of your mouth. There'd be testimony. The only testimony value I can see in that is that there's a biological relationship of father to daughter there, and that she, for whatever reason, you know, she is suffering under the autism, but she doesn't say that. But I think this is at best indirect, and so there you run into what Supreme Court decision says that the state courts were not entitled to view this as non-reversible error.
And, Your Honor, the difficulty here is, although you mention that he was her biological father and the question was, are you my daddy, it's actually a bit more complicated here because MC ran up to strangers on the street and said, will you be my daddy? The word daddy to MC did not have necessarily the meaning that it would have to most of us because of her autism. So that she identified her attacker as her daddy does not necessarily mean that it was her father, where she had called others her daddy.
That's true, but that's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant to this part. Now, I'll tell you what I think your strongest argument is, but then also what I think the problem with it is. I think it's the argument that her lawyer, that Mr. Carter's lawyer, did not put his own expert on autism on the stand. So all we have is Dr. Murphy, who, you know, may be fine, maybe she's a little bit marginal, who knows. But what's missing from this is what a different expert on autism might have said about the echolalia, about the comments from the little boy at school, was she conflating two stories? But we have nothing in this record to tell us what, you know, no proffer or anything of what some hypothetical other expert would have said. So that's where, although I think this was a very questionable decision on the part of the lawyer, I'm kind of at a loss of what to do with that fact.
Your Honor, one of the things that another expert would have said is that Dr. Murphy's conclusions about autistic children's inability to lie are not categorically true.
But she didn't say they were categorically true. She said, I would never say never, you know, she just says they're very concrete, and the kind of bald-faced lie of, you know, do I have a book in my hand? No, you know, when I do, isn't something that comes easily to them. But there are many other nuances, and she admits that.
What she didn't do, though, is tie those specific tests to MC herself. The studies
but
show...
But that's different from saying that she just said autistic kids can't lie. She didn't say that.
Well, what she did was say that generally children with autism have difficulty deceiving. She then went on to testify.
Is that true or false?
It is true in some circumstances, but the truth of it varies on the specific nature.
Well, that's consistent with what she said.
So, right, she qualifies it. And, you know, there are let me just give you examples of things that I think she didn't go into that maybe some other expert could have, which might be A, the difference between autistic boys and autistic girls, B, the just as you were saying, you know, tying this evidence about confusing other men for maybe her father or whatever, you know, this kind of fictional thing, her inability to create a reliable timeline, but there's just no evidence. We can't reverse a decision of the state courts based on anything except the evidence that was before those courts. That's what Harrington against Richter tells us. We're stuck with the record.
The difficulty here is that because Mr. Carter was proceeding pro se during his post-conviction relief, he raised all of these issues in his briefing, and he did cite autism evidence.
Where have you... I know, what are these... You say something... I'm looking at page 33 of your brief. You say it is... not a singular disease, and not all autistic children have the same disabilities. And then you cite SA 701, people with autism present across a spectrum of impairment with great variability in clinical symptoms, levels of functioning. What is that a quotation from?
It's a quotation, I believe, from an article on autism. There are several articles on autism that Mr. Carter submitted to the court on post-conviction relief.
You don't discuss any of those.
The references to the appendix are...
You don't say that, right?
Right.
Look, in order to You have to show that there is a, there are autism experts who would give testimony contrary to Murphy. I don't see where you saw that, where you say that.
Mr. Rawls never even investigated any experts. He never
you investigate. Look, you can't get a new trial by saying the lawyer didn't investigate unless you have some reason to, unless you can show that the investigation would have been fruitful.
And, Your Honor, here at this level, we are bound by the record on appeal.
But you can make a proffer. That's why I used that word. It's done all the time in post-conviction where somebody will say, here's Dr. Smith, you know, from, you know, the Mayo Clinic or whatever, some respected place. And Dr. Smith says that autistic girls in particular are going to conflate stories and they're very verbal and they, in fact, do create scenarios that do not correspond with reality. They're not lies per se. They're not like, is there candy in the box? And, you know, there's literature out there, but that's not our job to go find all that literature.
I understand. And one of the literature that I do cite in my brief is a literature, for example, that says that the child's ability to lie about whether there's candy in the box varies on factors such as intelligence. Now, just because a child is autistic doesn't mean...
You cite that. You don't have anything like that in your table of authorities.
It's cited to the... It's in the supplemental appendix, Your Honor.
That's not adequate. Look, let me ask you a different question. Does Indiana have anything like Rule 414 of the Federal Rules of Evidence?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, but I have not...
That's kind of important, because he has a history, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, 414 and 412 and 413, they're exceptions to the no propensity evidence rule for sex cases.
Yes, Your Honor. And the district court did, in fact, address, I don't know the specific Indiana rule that they talked about, but...
Well, that's a killer for him.
The right? Indiana court did...
Any doubts, I think, they're of his guilt, I think they're dispelled by his history.
Your Honor, the Indiana courts determined that it was too far removed. I believe it was 18 years prior to the trial. So the Indiana courts determined that it was too far removed from the case to be relevant to his conviction. It was still...
So it was inadmissible?
That's correct.
And so there wasn't any reference to it at the trial?
There was not. It only came into play in that he pled guilty to the habitual offender allegation without admitting to the underlying conduct. He did not challenge the habitual offender charge. But it did not. The state court trial judge did decide to exclude it from evidence. Your Honor, if you have no further questions, I'll...
Okay, thanks very much, Ms. Melvin. Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This Court should affirm the District Court's denial of habeas relief because there has been no violation of clearly established federal law asserted by the petitioner in this case.
Of course, it is pretty well established, I'm thinking of cases like Wiggins against Smith, that one way in which counsel can be ineffective is by failing to investigate a promising line of inquiry. And autism is a complex disorder. In fact, it's just being revised in the DSM right now, according to what I heard the other day. And the fact that this lawyer, we do know that the lawyer never put Mr. Carter's own expert on. All we have is Murphy. And even without anything else, you would think there are a lot of red flags in this record, including the statement by the boy about what happens if you put something in your mouth, and other things that would make you think perhaps this is actually a montage of experiences that she's blended together. She clearly is trying to take it back. You know, once she's made this allegation, it seems to penetrate to her mind that this is going to be catastrophic for her father. And she's uncooperative at trial. She says over and over again, I don't want you know, bad things happened to my father. So I'm concerned about the actual evidence of guilt that you relied on, this very unreliable autistic child.
Your Honor, well...
She tells the same story again, but they perseverate, so that doesn't tell me anything.
Initially, I'll just say that there is no claim under Jackson v. Virginia before the court and wasn't raised on habeas review.
But that's why I said, did I say
that? Well, it
that?
Wasn't raised
I
in
said,
this appeal, I'm sorry.
I believe I was talking about ineffectiveness of counsel mm-hmm. for failing to call an expert, which is a preserved claim. It's not procedurally defaulted. I'm not talking about Jackson against Virginia.
I understand,
Your
Honor. I
don't know
Honor.
What the evidence would have been. And there are many instances in which there's enough evidence from a Jackson point of view, except a properly instructed jury looking at the proper package of evidence still might have come out the other way. Your confidence in the result is undermined if you want to use the prejudice terms of Strickland.
The kinds of things that you talked about, her vacillations, her bizarre associations, these are the kinds of things that trial counsel tried to use to persuade this jury.
But with no expert. I mean, who cares what Mr. Rawls thinks? There's no solid foundation for explaining to the jury what this really means in the context of a severely autistic girl.
Your Honor, Dr. Murphy provided testimony
about
that.
Yeah, but she wasn't a friendly witness, and there are other views on autism, which if one does browse through these articles in the appendix, it's very clear they're out there. You know, and I am drawing a distinction between what was properly put in evidence and what wasn't, but if you're dealing with ineffective assistance of counsel under Wiggins, if the lawyer just completely falls down on the job in a whole line of inquiry, that's troublesome. That could be deficient performance, and it could be that there's prejudice.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the record shows that he fell down on the job. He testified
to... He never puts an autism expert in. He never... That's what I'm saying is the falling down on a job. To just rely on the state's autism expert, I mean, that'd be like relying on the state's competency expert where they come in and they say, oh, sure, you know, he was competent when he killed A.
Your Honor, I think this record shows that trial counsel reasonably concluded that regardless of whether he had presented his own expert or tried to urge some different theory of autism, that it would have been any more persuasive to this jury.
Oh, I don't think it shows that at all. Once you begin to look at the literature that's there, it could be that she was confusing stories that she'd heard around school and she attributed them to her father, and she has a very loose connection with who people are anyway. And once she realized this was being taken for real, she tried to pull it back, but it was too late because she told... Because once they've told the same story, they're going to tell it again and again and again and again. So the fact that she repeats it to the police officer doesn't really tell me anything other than she's perseverating, which is what they do.
Your Honor, trial counsel argued that very fact, and Dr. Murphy did not disagree with that characterization.
But you understand Judge Wood's point that having a defense expert is different than a prosecution expert. And then there are other things he didn't investigate, like the possibility that the older brother was the molester before making a decision not to mention the brother at all. And he says he didn't do it in part because he didn't have the resources. And don't you think if the jury knew there was another adult male in the house, given all the problems with MC's testimony, that she couldn't even identify her own father, I mean, that would be significant.
And the brief test with the big boy briefs or whatever they
call them. The big boy briefs, right.
Let's see if I can respond to each of those concerns. Your Honor, first of all, with the notion of including in the defense that she probably is remembering or perceiving something that didn't happen the way that she's communicating it, which was trial counsel's theory, which was not inconsistent with Dr. Murphy's testimony. If you wanted to add to that, and her older half-brother lived in the basement... Well,
your argument is that these are so inconsistent that no lawyer would do it, but I don't buy that at all. It seems to me the lawyer says, who can get inside the mind of a 9-year-old or 8-year-old autistic girl? It's most likely that, you know, she conflated the whole thing, but there is, in fact, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, another possibility, which is that the person who wears the kind of clothing that she remembers is the one who did it.
We are partially saying that, Your Honor, that it's inconsistent.
I don't see what you're
saying. And that it could weaken the argument that it never happened. But in addition to that, this whole business about the big boy briefs, in Megan's testimony, I'm sorry, MC's testimony, I apologize. In MC's testimony and in what she talked about on the tape and what her mother testified to, she had the confusion about the big boy shorts, and the mother confronted her and said, well, Daddy doesn't wear big boy shorts. Big boy shorts were...
And she says, so maybe Daddy mm-hmm. didn't do it.
Right. Right, and the jury heard that. But then
it becomes even more significant that there was an adult male in the house that wore those very kind of briefs.
No, but see, that's not the testimony. That's not the evidence, Your Honor, if I may clarify. The evidence is that her younger, also autistic brother, Marcus, wore the big boy briefs, as it were. And that's where the confusion came in.
Actually,
there is no testimony about
that. Actually arguing that someone else might have done it? I thought the argument was that she fabricated this.
That was the argument, Your Honor.
Right. So that's the brother is irrelevant, right?
From our position,
well, I don't think they argue that either.
Oh, I think they're arguing that.
No,
they
don't. Their argument is she made it all up. They can't have it both ways. She made it all up and the brother did it.
Well, the petitioner in post-conviction proceedings argued that he should have argued that the brother did it. Mm-hmm. The trial theory was...
How could she argue both that the brother did it and that she made it up? I don't get that.
And, Your Honor, if I may address something that you touched on while you were speaking with Ms. Melvin. There is a problem with the prior. Now, what happened at trial was the state moved to have the evidence of the prior child molest conviction entered. And Indiana does have a corresponding evidentiary provision, which is Rule 404B. There is an exception to that, and what the state...
So you have a 414 analog as well, or just 404B?
Your Honor, I apologize. I apologize for my ignorance on that fact. I've tried to think of a corollary to 414, and all I know is that 404B was the evidentiary.
Well, it may not. I mean, 414 was added much later in the federal system.
I am unaware of if Indiana has a counterpart to it.
Getting back, though, to this brother, because what I wanted to focus on, he didn't even investigate the possibility of the brother. Let's put that aside from the trial strategy and whether or not that would have been inconsistent. He didn't even investigate the possibility it could have been the brother, as I understand the record, because he said he didn't have the resources.
Well, Your Honor, I do have to quibble with that characterization somewhat, in that he said that there were many things that counsel, this late after his representation, could not remember. He said that he couldn't call precisely, but there could have been resource concerns about this. But even assuming that there were resource concerns about it,
why was Mr. Rawls disbarred?
Mr. Rawls was suspended from practice, and he was suspended from practice for a mingling of client funds in a case. Right. It had nothing to do with his actual representation of a client before a court. But with respect to the big boy shorts, counsel knew that the confusion had to do with the younger autistic brother, not the older brother, and he also knew that the older brother was living in the house. So it's not as if he didn't apprise himself of these circumstances and what evidentiary import they might have had. But aside from that, with Indiana's rule, the state argued mistake. Well, mistake didn't really fit to get this prior in, and the trial court denied the motion to have that part of the record. Now, if he was going to argue that it was an actual mistake of identity, that is a separate exception. Trial counsel doesn't want to run that risk by offering an also-and theory of defense.
What was his 18-year-old offense?
I'm sorry, sir?
What was his 18-year-old offense?
It was a child molest, Your Honor. I believe it was a C felony child molest, but I am not entirely certain.
That was his only prior sexual offense?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe that's right. And I guess my main response to these concerns is that there is nothing in this record that suggests that trial counsel was unaware of the schools of thought regarding autism, Judge Wood, I think you're entirely correct that the DSM is still being updated, and I think that that was even reflected in Dr. Murphy's testimony at trial, which was a long time ago, but it doesn't surprise me that there's continuing development in the area. But the trial counsel said he spent a multitude of hours. He was at the Indiana Medical School Library. He spoke with professionals that work with autistic children. And there's nothing in the record that establishes that he wasn't aware of these other avenues that he could have explored. But the thing is, trial counsel had wanted to exclude the witness as incompetent. That was his main thrust. And when the trial court found the witness competent.
You're talking about Dr. Murphy? Or
No, MC.
MC, yeah.
He found her competent. And at that point, if MC is going to be presenting her account to the jury, at that point, all these other sources of information become useful to trial counsel because he has to explain it. It's
right,
interesting.
And that's why it's a mystery to me that he doesn't put his own expert on, because as you've just conceded, there are many different views of autism, and it presents itself in many different ways, and another expert might have taken quite a different view from Dr. Murphy's. That's my only concern.
I just wanted to clarify the only preserved claims before this court are trial counsel's ineffectiveness for failing to object to the prosecutor's exchange, which was discussed with Ms. Melvin, he was ineffective for not attacking Dr. Murphy's testimony as vouching. And in Indiana, the law is clear that if something only allows an inference that the witness is testifying truthfully, that's not going to be an impermissible vouching witness.
What arguments did she make, if any, that you think are not preserved?
Arguments about trial counsel's failure to object to the admission of the videotape. Trial counsel's ineffectiveness.
With the expert testimony?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Anything to do with the expert testimony, or did she preserve that?
Your Honor, I did not perceive as preserved, as Judge Wood suggested, a claim that he was ineffective for failing to present his own
expert.
I think he did.
He raises to the post-conviction review court the failure to investigate the autism, and that's raised in his appeal, and it's raised in the district court. I think he's preserved four things, and the rest of it, no. I agree with you that he's not preserved the video or the mother's testimony, because that gets dropped in the post-conviction appeal, and he doesn't go forward on the Rule 702 Daubert, whatever you want to call it, point in the district court, so that falls out there. And there are some things that are gone.
And Your Honor, and just in response to your concerns, to conclude here, with respect to Dr. Murphy's testimony and his, may I finish?
Please, Your Honor.
MC had recounted to in her testimony and on the video that it had been raining on the day that she had told her mother about this, and that she'd had to use an umbrella, and she becomes preoccupied with these things, and it seems significant to her. This was a perfect example of this sort of disjointed disassociation that occurs with autism sufferers. And then there was the additional evidence of a boy at school talking about the reactions of male genitalia when placed in a mouth. And this was the fodder, along with petitioner's wife's testimony, that she had said, well, maybe daddy didn't do it.
Right, and my concern about the boy, for example, since we don't know whether he said it 6 months before that day, she's very unclear on times, is whether that made an impression with her and she confabulated some sort of story. But I understand your point.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. So, Ms. Melvin? Let me try to get clear exactly what you think another autism professor would have would have testified to?
Yes, Your Honor. There are a number of things. One is...
Do you have any question about Murphy's qualifications to testify?
Not her qualifications to testify on autism, just the methods that she used in arriving at her opinions.
Her methods what?
The methods she used at arriving at her opinions.
What's wrong with her methods?
Well, what she did is she took a test that had been performed generally on autistic children, and she spoke about it in general without acknowledging specifically the factors specific to MC that could have affected it. For example, MC is highly intelligent. Her own experience with MC recognized that MC was highly intelligent, yet she didn't acknowledge that highly intelligent children are more likely to perform well on this test, in other words, be able to deceive. What she did, in effect, was give expert testimony based on a generalized study that had been done on autism. Then she gave testimony regarding her experience with MC. What this did was to essentially tell the jury, I'm an expert and these are the general...
That's what experts always do.
But they need to relate.
So you're saying that that her testimony was inadmissible?
What I'm saying is that...
No, answer my question.
Yes, I'm saying it's inadmissible.
Yeah, well, that's untenable. Now, what is it you think that a defense autistic expert would have said?
There are a number of things. One is the echolalia and the tendency to repeat statements that others have said. This includes delayed echolalia, which means that autistic children sometimes repeat statements long after they were made. This can be statements of others. It can also be their own statements, as Judge Wood pointed out, that they can tell the same stories over and over and over again. Another expert also would have told the jury that the test upon which Dr. Murphy relied was not absolute, and that children like MC are more likely to perform well and are more likely to be capable of deception, and that in fact that expert could have given credence to Jessica Carter's testimony that MC was highly abstract and highly imaginative. An expert would have said that that is possible among children with autism. Another example is MC's...
When you say deception, is the argument that she was lying or that she was confused?
The argument...
She's lying? She doesn't like her father? She wanted to send him away?
No, Your Honor. It's not that she was lying. It's that she did not know what the truth was.
Use the word deception.
Your Honor,
if autistic children are capable of deception, there still has to be a motive. Is there any basis for thinking she would have lied in order to get her father in trouble?
No, Your Honor. The
Wouldn't it be a matter of confusion?
The word I should have used was imaginative, that she was very imaginative and abstract. And I see
now, what about this business with the brother? Is he really trying, or should his lawyer have been arguing both that she made it up because she's hyper-imaginative, as you said, and that, well, if she didn't make it up, her brother did it? Is that...
Your Honor, I think...
Is that a good defense strategy?
I think the defense strategy is what Judge Wood pointed out.
Answer my question. Is that a good defense strategy?
That, specifically in this case, could be, because the issue here is we don't know what's going on in this child's mind.
But it's not a mind question if it's the brother, right?
Right, and it could have been her brother, because she has difficulty identifying people.
Saying that sexual molesters have a kind of free shot at mentally disturbed children because there's always the possibility that they made it up or that someone else did it. They either confused the identity of the assailant or the entire thing was fabricated.
No, Your Honor, I do not believe it gives them a free shot. Here, I think the issue is that there's no evidence from what Mr. Rawls actually presented at the trial.
What evidence would you expect in a case like this?
What I would expect Mr. Rawls to present an autism expert who would testify about the nature of her autism.
What expert could say more than this expert said?
An expert could...
How, in other words, could a case like this ever be prosecuted? successfully, in your
view? Your Honor, a jury needs to know about, for example...
No, answer my question.
It could be prosecuted if the jury was presented with full facts regarding the nature of her disability, not merely one expert.
You had two experts, and one says these children rarely lie, and the other says this. She might have been hyper-imaginative because she's intelligent. The other would say, no, but she's young. What would a jury do with that?
Then a jury would be able to weigh that appropriately and come to a conclusion.
How do they weigh? How does a jury weigh two competing experts?
Juries weigh two competing experts quite often.
Do you really believe that they can do that?
Yes, I do.
You believe that?
That they can weigh two...
naivete.
That they can weigh two competing experts?
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, right?
Correct.
So we thank you for your vigorous efforts on this.